think we can start our little discussion about liberation theology. First thing that I would like to say is that we four, Carlos, Cruz, Juan and I, we discussed it something and we decided that I would make some open remarks, about 20 minutes, and then after we will have a discussion. And so not only I will respond to the questions, but the four of us will do it. Well, to understand liberation theology and to try, you know, to be aware what liberation theology is, I think it's necessary for people to understand the history, the whole history of Latin America and Brazil, because our history is a history of oppression and expropriation. It's very easy to see it, because if you analyze the process of colonization that happened in Latin America, you will see that from the beginning, the ruling countries look to our continent only with the purpose, you know, to pick some of the goodies that we had there and transport them to the metropolis. You can see, for example, the Portuguese in the beginning, and the Spanish people also, they didn't have any plans to settle Latin America. They only wanted to take the gold, the silver, the wood, and to enrich the elite of their countries. After a while, they discovered that our continent was also a very good place to have big plantations, so they didn't need to exhaust their lands in their countries. They could exhaust and exploit the lands of the people who lived down there. And so we have very interesting examples. For example, when the sugarcane was a good product in the market, the countries began, Portugal and Spain mostly, they began to start big, huge farmers in South America with the purpose to raise sugar and get a lot of money. After sugar became, you know, not so a good product for trade, they introduced cotton, and then after rubber, and then coffee, and now we have soybeans as the biggest product. After the 50s, lots of farmers, small farmers that grew, you know, a little bit of potatoes, a little bit of corn, influenced by the international capital, they stopped to raise this kind of crops and began to raise only soybeans. And then when they needed to buy potato, they need to go to the city and buy it with a lot, you know, and the price was very, very expensive. And so this is give you an idea that our history is a history of exploitation, expropriation. And this also reflects, this history also is reflecting in our theology. During the 20th century, after World War II, the industrialized countries, they also, you know, noticed that some countries in the world were, that as they called, underdeveloped. And so they decided that they needed to help these countries to achieve a status as that could be a more just status. And so what they thought was that if they, the ruling, the countries, the United States and the countries of Europe, if they could help the countries in Latin America to improve their conditions, we would have a harmonious or equal development of both countries, the first world and people and countries in Latin America. But the facts show it, that it didn't happen. Why? This is one of the questions. Why? Because for the system that we are living in Latin America, it's necessary to have some countries that can provide cheap raw materials, cheap labor, and in this cheap raw material can go to the industrialized countries, and they will manufacture these products, and then they will sell it again to the countries that send the raw materials, but with a difference. They pay a little for the raw materials, and now the countries that wanted import the products, they need to pay a lot. And so during the 50s, people became aware that this kind of relationship doesn't work. And they started to think that if we in Latin America wanted to have a just system, a just society, we can't not only make some little reforms, you know, putting some band-aids in some areas, but we need to change the relationship, the social system. And some people did it, some people are trying. Some people try it, do it, and they were overthrown. And so this history of oppression in one side and tentatives to overcome this situation of oppression is very clear, is very present in our history. And so this situation of oppression and at the same time, you know, people trying to overcome this situation also reflected in a new theological development that we call liberation theology. Most of the people that we speak here in the United States, they think that liberation theology is a product of the head of some people, some theologians, that saw this problem and then now they started to think about and then they discovered liberation theology. But it's not true. Liberation theology is not a product of the head of some illuminated people, but it started in this process of conscientization that our situation of oppression is not a natural cause, but is caused by someone else. It's a systemic problem. And so during the 50s, we will have some people, mostly in the Catholic Church, that began to think that a new kind of pastoral work should be done with people, mostly poor people, because where the poor people that suffered most in this system of exploitation. And this consciousness of the situation of oppression also helped the theologians after a while to discover what is the role of the church in this situation. It's not only the role of the church is not only to forgive people of their sins, but also to point to the problems, to the conflicts that we are living in society. Liberation theology always is accused to be a theology that will cause conflicts. But what we are saying is that we don't cause the conflicts. The conflicts are already there. What people are doing is only to see the conflicts and are trying to deal, to work with these conflicts, trying to find some solutions. Sometimes they find the solutions, sometimes they don't, they can't. Because the problem is not so easy. As I said, Liberation theology is very has a lot a very strong support among the poor people, because was where the poor people that first began to organize themselves to try to change the relationship that we had in society. It was the poor people that, for example, in Chile supported a government that was elected by the majority of the people that was trying to change, and then after some years of government, they were overthrown by the help of the CIA in the United States. Was also the poor people that tried to do something new in Argentina and was overthrown. And also, I think is the poor people that's trying to build a new society in Nicaragua right now. And then these people looking at this situation started to systematize what these groups of oppressed people were doing. And so in 1968 in Medellin, a conference of Catholic bishops, this new theological formulation was at the first time present in the official documents of the Catholic Church. And this sometimes gave the impression for most of the people that the liberation theology was, you know, was started and was formed during the Medellin conference, but it's not true. It's more old than this. And one of the biggest consequence of liberation theology for us today in Latin America, and I think is the most beautiful thing that happened, is this the formation or the spread of the base communities in Latin America, and even here in the United States, you can find some. The base community represents a new kind of church, we can say, a new kind of concept of church, because it's not centered in the hierarchy or in the person of the priest, of the pastor, but the people gather together, they share their problems, they share their dreams, they share their frustrations, but what they are teaching us is that we can be democratic in these situations. We can try together find solutions for our problems. And their activities and their struggles helped the theologians to form what we call now the liberation theology. And I would like to say what are the principal points or the major points of liberation theology that maybe can help it a little bit in our discussion. For example, liberation theology has a strong biblical foundation. When we look to the Bible, we see clearly that God chose one side of history. We can see it very clear in the Exodus, when God heard the cry of the people in Egypt and liberate these people of the oppression of Egypt, and show that are the oppressed, the ones that don't have anything to lose, that are the vehicles of God's actions in this world. They are not the saints. They are not sinless. they committed sins. But they are through these weak people that God shows what he or she wants to us. And the other event that's very central to liberation theology is the cross of Jesus Christ. Because on the cross, we see a radical commitment of God to bring justice and to bring life to this world. If in the Exodus we have a political liberation, in the cross we have a radical change. It's not only more a change of political system, but also a change of the relationship between people. Because in the cross, where we have clearly showed again that God chose the weak. Jesus was not among the elite. He was a peasant. He walked with sinners, with women, and all kind of marginalized people. Is through these people again that God shows what he wants to us. And so, liberation theology is basically a biblical theology also. A second point very important to liberation theology is that salvation is not an event that will happen far away from us, but salvation is happening right now among us. And how does it happen? It happens when people committed themselves in any kind of organization that try to change the situation of oppression and sin that we are living right now. And when I say any kind of organization, this means that you don't, liberation theology don't think that only individual commitment will solve the problems. People as a group organized, have more power than one individual. He or she can have the best intentions, but if people are together, their force is strength. Their strength is bigger. A third point that is very important for us is that we, as liberation theologians, recognize that our theology is partial. It's historical. We have some presuppositions, and we admit it. And what we want to do, and what we want, is that other theologies also admit it, that they have presupposition, that they have a kind of ideology behind it. Because what we have heard is that people accused liberation theology of being partial, and people say, oh, you are partial, but we are neutral in this conflict. And we believe that neutrality doesn't exist. Or we are committed with something, or we are against something. If you see someone dying, if you say, oh, he is dying, he is not, or you will say, I don't know, if the person died, you have the responsibility in this action. So this is a clear point. We are partial, and we recognize it. And we think that it's not a problem for us. Other thing that is very important in liberation theology is that liberation theology has an emphasis in the lay people, lay participation in the life of the church, not a passive participation as, for example, only attend trying to improve the attendance of the worship or other practices of the church. But the lay people are seen as people capable to make decisions and to formulate what they want to do, what they want the church do for them, for them. Because what we had during the history is that the church always said for the people what they needed, and we are saying we need to change this process. People need to ask the church what they want the church to do. One last thing that I would like to say is that even if liberation theology is accused to be a political theology that only wants to look for the sin that are present in the structure, liberation theology says also that the sin that is also present in the individual, but has connections with the structural sin, and we need to change both the individual and the structures, and not try to separate them, as mostly it's being doing. It's been done. I can finish here, and we could now share, you know, questions and opinions.
I'd like to sort of paraphrase a quote. Bishop Camara said, "When I help the poor, I am called a Christian. When I ask why they are poor, I am called a communist." And this is a problem I see with the acceptance of liberation theology in our Western culture, as we interpret any kind of questioning of the status quo as being a communist plot. And I want to know what your opinions are of these kinds of problems, overcoming this.
You are right. People in Latin America who try, you know, to ask the question why people are poor, they always are condemned and are rotulated by the word communism. And this in this work, you know, we are so afraid of this word. Even if you don't know anything about what communism is, if only you label one people, you are again. And I think this is one of the weapons that, you know, people that don't want changes will use it always. It's very hard to convince them that you are not a communist. And what people are doing is that is show that their actions are based in the gospel of Jesus Christ, and they try to relate, see what Jesus did. We are only trying to follow what Jesus did. Maybe we are a little bit different, but it is natural because the situation changed so much. But it's true, it's difficult to do it.
What method would the liberation theology use? Does liberation theology advocate using violence to bring the changes around?
Well, good question.
Hang on a minute.
Okay.
Is Jessica's mother here? Jessica? Who's 12? Oh, good. Thank you. Sorry.
Oh, no problem. Well, I will go a little bit further. I think it's very interesting that people, when they are speaking about liberation theology, they always will accuse the oppressed that are trying to change the situation to be violent, to use violence. But I would like to make you know, to show that we see violence in very different situations. We see that violence is happening every day when millions and millions of children don't have enough food to eat. People are dying without any medical assistance. This also is violence, is a systemic violence. And we saw also another kind of violence, is the violence that is done by the regimes that don't want to change. For example, you can see, for example, in Brazil we had 21 years of military dictatorship, and everyone that would speak against the government was, you know, I would say 90% with chance to be arrested and suffer any kind of violence. And so the violence of the oppressed, I think, is the less tentative, the less attempt to change something. I think liberation theologians will say people need to try any kind of change through a non-violent process. We prefer this one. But we know that people sometimes never don't want to give up what they have. A good example, I think, is Nicaragua. How many of you believe that Somoza would give up some of his privileges of the people? It's difficult. If someone is in power and have privileges, they never will give up. Even in our common lives, we don't like to give up some privileges. And imagine what kind of privileges these kind of people have. And so liberation theologians will say, right, you need to change. Try any kind of non-violent. If they don't work, sometimes you need to use violence. And what is important, they are saying, this use of violence is not a kind of saint war. It is a sin that you are committing. But it's a bigger sin not do anything.
Mm-hmm. Maintain the situation.
Yeah, because then you are maintaining the situation.
A violent situation.
Yeah, a violent situation. It's not so easy to say, yeah, okay, now we will do something violent or make a revolution. No, you are killing people. Sometimes people that don't know what is going on, they are forced to go into the army. But if you are seeing that violence is happening, you need to do something to change.
The person asked also about methodology. Maybe we could speak a little about the methodology that is used to do theology in the third world or in Latin America. We have three steps called to see, to judge, and to act. Ver, julgar, e agir. The first step is people, maybe Germano used this method in his presentation. First, he saw our history, our human condition in our countries. And then the Bible judged this situation. And that we see that the Bible has something to say to this situation we are living. And then we act. And then nourished by the Bible and orientated by the Bible, we act, trying to change the structures. And when we speak about structures, I don't know if everybody understands what we think about structures. Maybe we could just change the word structures by law. Change the laws. We have a law in Brazil, for example, that we know better, that says that the minimum income, the minimum salary in Brazil is $58 per month. That's a law. The representatives wrote this law and they approved it. And with this, a family have to survive. And so it's not, if you want to see, it's not unjust, it's the law. But if you live with this, you can. And so what we call changing structures, we think, change the laws that runs our countries. Mostly, yeah, sure, we have many other parts that compound the structure, but mostly I would say change the laws. And it's not easy. It's not easy to change the laws. And it demands a big effort, really a big effort of everybody. Because people is really very easily deceived by the powerful. I think that you can see it here in the United States too. That the powerful, they say to people, you see, we did it. We can do it for you too. And it's a big temptation for the people to accept this. And then they make rules and laws that they will always privilege, always give more and more for themselves. And they have all these excuses to say, oh, you have to wait a little more. We are trying to, we will do it, and never have.
Well, what specifically are you doing in the name of liberation theology? You talked about changing laws. What specifically are you doing to bring about liberation theology? To help the poor to make the changes? What example?
That's a good question.
Well, I think this is, again, liberation theology is don't say that only the church has the answers for all the problems. The church is one vehicle that can bring changes to the world. But we think that, for example, in the political changes, people, Christians that are committed with Christ, must organize themselves and try to do something through the channels that the political world can give you. For example, liberation theologians say, if you want to change a law, for example, go to a political party and try with another people that sometimes are not Christian to change this law that don't allow, for example, in the example of Carlos, you know, that say that a minimum income is $58. Try to change it. In other sectors, for example, in people are organizing themselves to demand a better educational system, using the church is with the people trying to do something. It's not as we had before, that the church would say, no, only we have the power to change something in the world. Liberation theology, no. The church is one of the vehicles that can change the structure in our world.
I have an example. Last year in July I went to the North East and there was a seminar about hunger. And one of the pastors who were there, he went to a meeting with the servant. And when he came back, he was there for 3 weeks, for 3 days. And when he came back, he said, well, I was really challenged because they say, we know you are a pastor, and they were 300 peasants. And they said, you are committed with us and you will do something for us, or you can go back because we don't need somebody to come here and just look and see what's going on and don't do anything. We need you, but doing something.
In fact, another example, from our church, we had an intern who's presently down and he's a pastor now in Ecuador. And she was, for her first 3 years, all she did is try to organize the church she was involved with, because every year they had floods. And so every month she'd be taking a group of people down there saying, hey, we need dikes. You know, this is a big inconvenience. People die, and, you know, with the land and everything. And after 3 years, she was all frustrated, you know, but finally people listened. And then the next year, you know, they started to say, hey, well, now that we've got the dikes, which it seemed an impossibility, by them organizing together and them ending their rights, which were theirs, they got a school, and now they're working on a hospital. You know, and that's how the questions that they're asking are completely different than the questions we are. We all assume that we have schools and hospitals, and for people who don't, they're not so concerned whether how close we are to the Athanasian Creed or to the Apostles' Creed. You know, they're talking about life and death, some of the basics, which we just assume. So it's a totally different asking questions. We never assume, if, you know, as far as this violence question, I find it really humorous, you know, that it's even asked. I've been to three conferences, in fact, the first international conference on liberation theology in Vancouver, and someone again asked that, and they were just about laughed out of the building, because we never seem to question the billions of dollars which are spent, you know, here in Canada and in the States. You know, that's just assumed. You know, and especially for Americans who were born out of a revolutionary system, you know, and who glorified every July 4th, you know, we should be encouraging, you know, that sort of thing, just as apparently the states are doing with the Congress.
What?
Mm-hmm.
One of the main points I think happening, which is really helping the spread of base communities in not only Brazil but in Latin America in general, is the fact that of the church is saying, we are taking the position of the poor, we are making an option for the poor. And not, when I'm talking the church, I'm not saying about the official church, because everybody knows that the official church stands to say, hey, we want to make an option for the rich because we want to increase the amount of members. But what this has done is really, when communities make an option for the poor people, this means that for the first time in history, there is a place for the poor people in the church. Because in 500 years, the church has always been on the side of the oppressed. The missionaries came to Brazil with this sword in one... Pardon? The missionaries came to Brazil with the sword in one hand and with a cross in the other, and killing Indians. And this is the beginning of all. And I think the church has been converted in Latin America. And I think this is a big change going on.
Your comment touches on a question I'd like to ask the four of you folks. It seems to me that the interest of the church in the liberation of the people of Latin America is fairly recent, given the fact that those countries have been colonized for in excess of 300 years, and the Catholic Church in particular witnessed the slavery and the oppression of those people. I was wondering if you could speculate as to what might be behind this, what appears to me to sudden interest in liberating the people. If I'm accurate in saying that it is a sudden interest.
I would say that the claim of the people,
I think about
the claim of the people, the noise of the suffering of the people. In Exodus, that the man quoted, God heard the suffering of the people and sent not only Moses but many others, the people. We don't know the name. To help the people to organize and to conquer the liberation. And if you live in a country like we are living and you and you see every day people dying because they don't have medical care, because they don't have food. You know, it challenges you. You cannot be always, you can stay for 400 years with your eyes closed, or pretending to be with your eyes closed. But when the situation is as big as it is now, in the last years in South America, in Latin America, you cannot stay anymore neutral. You feel challenged to do something, to change.
Yeah, or other thing, for example, liberation theologians are, you know, putting the finger right on the problem, saying also the church has no need to convert, because the church was on the side of the oppressor during a long time. You can find sometimes one or two individuals that maybe try to do something different, but the church as an institution, even the Protestant church, most were on the side of the powerful, and now they are again being, not because they wanted to change, but people are forcing the churches to change their vision.
Something which is happening also is that, and not only liberation theology, but many other groups of people are trying to rescue the memory of resistance of the oppressed people. And it's not happening only now during the last 20 years, but it happens during the whole history of humanity. And it happened also in the history of our country, where groups of people resisted to the power of the oppressors. When Indians resisted to becoming white, when blacks resisted to become Christians just because it would be an imposition of the white people, where they tried to mix their own African culture with Christianity, where landless or poor farmers tried to use Christianity as a means of organizing themselves and getting land to farm and to survive. And there are many, many examples, but the problem is that these examples are never part of the official history. And what's necessary to do, and many historians are doing it right now, and what we think that we are doing with the Bible, is to rescue this memory of the oppressed, which brings the power of resistance, and also the challenge for change.
And also for a long, long time, we had our doctors, our lawyers, they were Europeans, and they could be born in Brazil, but they went to Europe to study. And when we start to study in our country, and we have the material to do something, and we know that we can think about, because always we Brazilians are called by the Brazilians, we have the in our minds what you know how I can say, but we are lazy. We say that the people from the Northeast are lazy, and only in the South we work, and we don't know anything about the Northeast. And when we start to study about the Northeast, or when we go to the Northeast, we see that it's very different. And I think the same happened with the theology. First we had an European theology, and then we started to think about and what we can do, what are we thinking about our situation.
It's not easy to say what a Christian a based community is, but mostly is Christian based communities are formed, are composed by poor people that saw the necessity to came together and discuss their problems through the light, through the light of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And not only to study the situation, but also trying to find, as a group, a solution for their problems. And by doing this, you know, trying to see what's going on in their lives and trying to do solutions, they also discovered that they need, as a group, also to celebrate their faith. So a meeting of a faith community, you will have at the same time, you know, people discussing their problems and worshiping God and trying to find a solution for their problem. It's not only present in the Catholic Church, but we have also based communities in Protestant Church, and they are very ecumenical. They are open to every. They want the if you want to be a part, if you are committed with them, they will not ask you if you are a Catholic, if you are a Lutheran. They will ask you, you are with us, you want to struggle with us? Yeah, I want. Okay, done. You are our brother or you are our sister.
And the number of people in the faith community is not so big. Last year I heard that the number of faith communities that they know is 7,200. But we think that there are many more that we don't know. But it's interesting, the faith community is maybe 12 or 20 people. And we just like here, I'm not the pastor, or the priest, not the priest, is one of them. And we sit around and open our Bible, as Luther said, and we read the Bible and discuss. If you want to see a good example, Ernesto Cardenal, the Nicaraguan priest, he recorded many of those meetings, and the book, for book, for book.
Yeah, the Gospel of Solentiname.
Yes. Okay.
How does one find a faith community? Where are they?
Oh, usually in the what we call suburbs, but suburbs in Brazil is not the same like here in the United States.
Just the opposite.
Yeah. Because you know that I have always to speak too much. But around the cities, yeah, around the cities, the poor people is coming and settling this area.
Yeah, this is the center of the city where we will have the buildings and the rich people living, and the peasants and the poor people who come to find another job in the city, they will begin to build their house surrounding the center of the city. And so, for example, when you arrive in São Paulo, that is the biggest city, the first thing that you see will be the shanty towns and the slums and so on. And are in this area that you find faith communities.
Yes. In maybe neighborhood, 5-6 families, they gather and make a faith community. And if the priest can come, it's okay. If he doesn't come, it's okay too, it works, you know. But it really, as German said in the beginning, the hierarchy is not hierarchy, isn't it? But really, we all are brothers and sisters, and we share the gospel. And we see that the same history of God with the people in Israel and in Jesus Christ and after Jesus Christ, the same history is our history. There is not two histories. God is leading also our history. That's what we realize when we are gathered. And then we see, and God don't say us, okay, you are in a bad shape here, but after you die in the heaven, you will be in a good shape. God never says this in the Bible. Or somebody can say, I never found it. God says you have to have life. You have to have bread. That's why God shared the bread and gave not only the bread that is the faith, but the bread that you can eat also. Both are all these together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.